Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of The Victory Show. If this is the first time you're joining us, I'm Rachel League with Bestseller by Design. Our founder, Travis Cody, is the best-selling author of 16 books, and we've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books as well. Through that journey, we've discovered a fascinating pattern. Most businesses really struggle to break past the seven-figure revenue mark. On this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they used to scale way past that mark, so you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting now. Today's guest is Eric Ries, a seasoned commercialization strategist, marketing executive, and mission-driven entrepreneur who spent his career helping life science innovations reach the patients and markets that need them most. Eric is the CEO and co-founder of Forever North Partners, where he leads the development of the CASMIC system, a proprietary end-to-end commercialization framework that helps high-potential life sciences companies scale with speed, precision, and purpose. Through investor alignment, regulatory guidance, IP protection, clinical research support, and messaging strategies powered by key opinion leaders, Eric and his team at Forever North help bridge the gap between scientific promise and market impact. Eric's leadership roots run deep. He previously served as Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Sensica Technologies, which was acquired by Paul Corporation, and held senior roles at BioInspire LLC and Reese Marketing Consultants, where he built and executed market-driven growth across high-tech and diagnostic sectors. Beyond the boardroom, Eric is deeply committed to autism advocacy and inclusion. He served on the board of directors for New Vista School, a leading institution supporting students with ASD, for nearly a decade, and volunteers with Autism Speaks, supporting families and communities navigating the autism spectrum. With more than two decades of experience guiding breakthrough products from concept to market, and a personal commitment to making innovation more inclusive, Eric brings a wealth of insight, compassion, and vision to every conversation. Get ready for an incredible conversation about resilience, innovation, and what it really takes to scale a mission-driven business. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
You've led growth for multiple companies in the life sciences space, from BioFire to Sensica to Forever North. What first drew you to this world of scientific innovation and commercialization?
Sure. I've always liked science since I was a kid, particularly life sciences. And I wanted to go into the lab. You know, I really did. And I thought the lab would be a great place to cut your teeth at. But then I realized that all the people in the life sciences space is trying to get an academic position, it wasn't going to go too well. It's a long journey. So I wanted to take my life science skills and get into and learn the business end of sales and marketing with the life sciences community. So I spent some time in sales and in application science and in marketing. And I noticed that a lot of the ways that marketing is approached and sales is approached in the life sciences community is missing some key components. If you look at how sales and marketing is done, and one of that really is that whole peer-to-peer review process that scientists use to publish articles or use to present at shows and what have you, that really is not coming through the sales process. So I needed to get to a position where I could test that out and have some fun with it. And the last, I'd say about 10 to 15 years has been an incredible journey just developing out that piece of the puzzle and then working with clients to show them it works in your arena, regardless of where you're at, is the short answer to it. Yeah.
Great. And tell me, was there a moment in your career when you realized you just didn't want to support growth, but you wanted to start building this better system for scaling it?
Yes, yes. You know, it was one of those things, you know, when we were, myself and some of my business partners throughout the course of my career, most of my background has been in sales and marketing, even though I have a doctorate in cell molecular and developmental biology. The course of my career, again, sales and marketing. And so a lot of what we were offering to our clients was just strictly in that arena, in the arena of developing out what we refer to as field executable sales programs and market-driven applications programs for people to commercialize their product. And one of the things that my partners and I had talked about is, boy, we're leaving a lot on the table in terms of money. If you were to look at the whole life sciences commercialization process from all the way from product inception to commercial release, there's a lot of stuff, if you will, a lot of applications areas in there that my partners and I decided, boy, we can do that, or we know other experts to do it. So we decided, okay, we're going to put together a team of experts from different disciplines within business, anywhere from legal to human resources to social media, and put them all under one umbrella and then bring that forward to the client. And when we first did that, it wasn't the best system. And here's what the problem was. It wasn't the best system because we realized that we couldn't offer it soup to nuts to everybody, because some of our clients were like, well, I only need this and this. I don't need all of it. So we decided, what if we packaged it up into what we called an integrative system as compared to integrative? Integrative would be, or integrated would be, from soup to nuts all the way through. Integrative would mean that the client couldn't decide, well, I need sales and marketing and, let's say, commercial or clinical trials and someone help on legal, but I don't need HR, or I don't need creative product design. I don't need those aspects. So when we found out that we can customize it per client, it really started to take off, because now the clients that we work with running the gamut, some of them use the whole system, some of them use part of it. And it's that flexibility to pick and choose. And it really eliminated a problem that all our clients have. And then it's resoundingly clear for consultants. I'll let the cat out of the bag on that one. If you talk to a lot of people out there in the industry, they work with a variety of different consultants, but each consultant is on their own timeline. We're all on our own timelines. We're all on our own project lines, and we all have our own cost and structure. And so clients that we had worked with said, well, I'm using a variety of different consultants to accomplish commercialization. But the problem is you guys are all on different timelines. You're all speaking a different language, and you guys really don't work together too well. And so we told them, okay, well, what if we bring in an entire team that can do this or do functions of it, but it's all under one umbrella? So project management, time management, the whole ball of wax is under one group working for you, dear customer. And that's when it just started to really resonate well with people. And we took off from there. It really went well.
Yeah.
That was the aha moment. Yeah.
Great. It sounds like you were able to, pretty early on, understand what you needed to do to differentiate yourself from other consulting firms out there. And you were able to communicate that and address the need of your clients.
Yes.
So speaking of unique systems, tell us about the core idea behind the CASMEX system and how did you come up with it?
Sure. So CASMEX stands for Commercialization, Assessment, Sales, Marketing, Evaluation, and Clinical Trials or Technological Trials. And basically, if you were to look at the drug discovery and development pipeline, or even a product pipeline, there's the discovery phase of it and that development phase. And breaking it down into actual application areas, let's say if we were to take drug development, there's different steps that have to happen in order for a drug to get out to market. So what we did was take each of those pieces in, let's say, a development of a product or service, and decide, who do we know that does that particular application space that is another consultant or professional that does it really well, that really is a thought and an opinion leader for that particular application space? Because we did sales and marketing quite well, and my business partner does operations, particularly commercial operations, quite well. So we didn't know all of it, but we understood it, but we just, again, it's not the breadth of what we did. So when we started talking, what we refer to as collaborants, funny term is, business executives boldly going where no other executive has gone before. We were playing with names, marketeers, if you will. When we were talking with them and we told them, look, this is what we want to do. And we had some really good, strong individuals come out and say, I want to join what you guys are doing. And we told them, well, look, we think this is going to work. Not 100% certain, but we think we got something here because we've been testing it with clients. And that's one of the things that was key, was going out there and listening to the market itself. You know, you have an idea, and a lot of executives have some great ideas and entrepreneurs, but it's really great to get that market input and people that you know or trust and be able to say, hey, am I, you know, shooting up the pole here? Does this make any sense? And it just came resoundingly clear after a while, this is making a lot of sense to people. And again, it's because there's so many commercialization gaps and communication gaps when you're trying to commercialize a product and using a variety of different vendors. That was the aha moment, again, that really took off. And so the team likes it in that it allows them quite a bit of flexibility and an ability to customize their workflow and their involvement as well. Now, each one of our senior leaders that we have that's available on our website, as you can see on the website at forevermp.com, each of those senior leaders has their own team as well. So I'm just showing the odd 12 or 13 of us, but each of them has anywhere from a team of 2 individuals to 10 individuals. So it allows a lot of flexibility within the customer space And they run the gamut of backgrounds. You know, if you look at our customers that we share on the website, I've mostly focused my career on life sciences, but we've done anything from KB toys to drinking water. Because a lot of what we do, although we have technical expertise in life sciences, the underlying methodology is repeatable. And I think that's what really makes it well resonate well with our clients. You know, with clients, they feel sometimes that, well, I'm hiring you as an executive, but I want the ability to divorce you at one point. You know, I don't want to have you forever. And as a client, a consultant, that's a good thing if you've done a good job. So we developed a system that once we teach it to somebody, after running through it once or twice, they could integrate it into their own workflow. And that's been really great. You know, at first we thought, well, man, are we really cutting off our throat or cutting our throats here? Because our average time span is between 3 to 6 to 12 months with a customer. But what we found out is that integration that they achieved within their own teams was our biggest referral system. They were telling their friends and colleagues, hey, look, these guys come in, they get you into the shape that you want to be in, and then they move on and they let you move on, and we just take time points with them. And it allows us to pick up other projects as well because they trust us. That trust was really, really key. The old additive of, you know, it takes a long time to make a good customer and seconds to lose one is resoundingly clear. We're establishing that relationship and building that trust, our feeder line from repeat and referral has been very good.
Yes, it sounds like you had a really clear assessment of the market need and then some early feedback that helped you confirm you had something that was
Yes, exactly. One of my mentors, I mentored with two key individuals in the course of my career, an individual named Steve Spotts and then another individual named Rick Brown. And they always told me you constantly need to get that marketing feedback. You know, because ideas, particularly in any type of science market, are ever evolving and evolve quickly. The market moves. So if you're not getting customer input or potential customer input to what you're doing, you run the risk of failure. And so one of the things that we tell our clients is a big thing that we do is bring in key thought and opinion leaders for your particular product or service. So it's not us telling, you know, you how great you are. It's the clients themselves. And explaining that as part of the science buying cycle. You know, it's just like publication or perish. The buying process for science is you have your key opinion and the thought leaders, and then you have your big portion of the Gaussian distribution of sales, where those are the followers that are going to buy because their peers are using it and or liking it. And the same philosophy holds true for scientific sales. Once you start integrating that into your own process, it works out very well. Whether you're actually as a consultant or being a consultant to someone selling a product or service, it holds true.
Was there a moment when you were getting market signals that weren't as positive and you had to pivot or shift your approach?
Sure. Yeah, there was. So one of the things that, you know, as I mentioned early on, you know, from a pure desire to make as much money as possible, I wanted to at first sell the whole system. I wanted to sell the whole system from soup to nuts because, of course, the price ticket on that is much bigger. And after a meeting, my partner and I traveled the country talking with a variety of different clients that we've either had in the past or new clients that we wanted to acquire. What is it we're missing here? What is it that you don't like about it? And after about the third visit, it was just resoundingly clear. It was the ability to customize. They told us, Eric, John, we would love to work with you guys, but we don't need all this. We need this, this, and this. And we'd go see another client and they would say, we don't need all this, but we need this, this, and this. So with that ability to customize, that early feedback really changed what we did. Now, at first, I got to be honest with you, I was being a little bit stubborn about it, saying, well, darn it, I want to sell the whole thing, because I was looking at the big puzzle here. And then I'm like, wait, you know, my mentors always told me, you know, you can't eat the elephant whole. Or the other one was, 9 women can't have a baby in a month. It takes its time. You know, it's got to mature and take its process. So realizing that and looking at, okay, well, what if I sold it in a bite-sized system where I can either sell individual portions of it or grouped portions of it, but I allow the customer to design. You know, do you need this, let's say, technical trials plus post-marketing surveillance, or you need help early on with your IP and design of your sales force? So once that really came through and I accepted that in my entrepreneurial spirit, I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And that's when we took off. That was the hit.
Yeah, a lot of really interesting points you touched on in there. One thing you mentioned was some advice from your mentors. Tell me a little bit about who throughout your career has been influential and what is it about those relationships that's helped you to continue to scale effectively?
Sure. Thank you. Two individuals in particular really stick out in the, you know, I've been fortunate to, well, first off, have some very great bosses throughout the course of my career, some very great managers. And I've also had some terrible ones. And to be honest with you, sometimes you learn more by the bad ones than the good ones. But the two that really stick out, individuals that I mentioned, Steve Spotts and Rick Brown. Steve Spotts, you know, a lot of the old school life science community, they used to say, if you were a thought leader in sales and marketing, you came out of Pharmacia. And there was a lot of great thought leaders that came out of thought Pharmacia in the business aspect of life sciences. And Steve was a great marketeer. He really was. And so I wanted to go into marketing. I was a sales rep at the time. And, you know, I was at a small company, and he and the current president of the company was an individual named Rick Brown. And Rick Brown's trick was to basically come in and get companies ready to sell themselves for larger profit to a bigger company. So working with those two, I told them, look, I don't know anything about marketing. So you can tell me marketing is a square circle. I don't know. Doesn't matter. I'm a blank slate. You know, they would have, of course, preferred to hire someone that knew marketing because we were a small company at MicroCal at the time. We were a small company, but, you know, lo and behold, Rick and Steve, we formed a personal kinship, and they said, okay, you know what, we're going to give you a shot, but you need to learn from us. You know, it's not you doing as we know you don't know how to do it, but we're going to show you how to do it. And that was really a turning point for me. And I could remember Steve, I used to get pissed at Steve, to be honest with you. He was more maternal, paternal to me in a variety of ways. One of the things he used to tell me is I would come in and ask him about some type of marketing problem or some approach I'd want to use. And you could tell he would know the answer. And he wouldn't tell me. He would say, Eric, go wander in the forest for a while. And I would say, you know what, damn, just tell me, you know. And he's like, no, I want you to go figure it out, because if you figure it out on your own, you'll learn from it. You'll understand it. If I give you the answer, I'm just going to give you the answer. And so sometimes I'd walk out of that room calling him every four letter in the book, thinking in the back of my head. But it was really a learning experience for me because, you know, of course, he would guide me along the way. But that guidance was to let me go out and make mistakes and learn from my processes. That was quite key. And Rick Brown himself, again, he was the CEO of MicroCal, a great guy. And, you know, I'm still in contact with Rick now. Rick was probably the hardest grader you've ever seen. You turn something into him, and he would never tell if he liked it or not. It was just blood red with all the corrections he did, you know? And so I was thinking, hey, did you like it? I can't tell my own writing. And later on in my career, he said, well, Eric, if I didn't like it, I would have never let you do it. And so I never realized that. And it wasn't until after my career ended at MicroCal, as I went on to the next stage, that I found out Rick really liked me quite a bit. I was like, wow. Could never tell, because he played it so close to the vest, because he was a very traditional executive in that point. So he showed me, you know, some of the skill sets as well as being an executive that I really admire and try to translate to those people that I mentor now. But it was that grading fashion of his that really helped me out in honing some of my own personal skills in sales and marketing.
Absolutely. And it shows an investment in you that he continued to help you, even if in red ink, tough love fashion.
But yeah.
So I loved how you described your first mentor telling you to go take a walk in the woods to figure out the problem. What is your approach to problem solving? What does that walk in the woods look like to you?
Sure. It's really, there's two portions of it. One of the biggest portions is don't come in with a loaded answer. And, you know, I see a lot of marketeers in the course of, you know, that we've worked with is a client, they're clients of ours. They have the answer, or they believe they have the answer, and they want to go find market data to support what they think. And the approach that I was taught that's very helpful is you have an idea or concept, and you're not coming with a loaded answer. You're going to let the market tell you. You're going to let the market tell you and educate you and refine whatever you're thinking. Of course, you know, you have your general hypothesis, just like you would in science. You have a general scope of what you want to do, but you're not trying to force fit what you already believe. You're having the market educate you to what it is that customers want to buy or will buy on. And, you know, there's the old additive of when you're trying to sell a customer, you got to think of what problems keep them up at night. One of the common things that Steve used to tell me is that our customers being, let's say, scientists in the drug discovery or development market, none of them wants to buy a single one of our products. And I looked at him, I'm like, you got to be kidding. He goes, they'd actually prefer not to buy it. I'm like, what do you mean we sell these things? He's like, no. He says, what you sell is something to solve a problem. That's all you sell. He says, this a life scientist, he says, if people, someone in drug discovery doesn't really care if they discover a drug with a toaster. It doesn't make any difference to them. They're not going to run out there and say, man, I got to buy your product because you're you or you or you. He says, they don't care. They develop it with a toaster. It doesn't make any difference to them. He says, the fact is that they accomplish their goal. He says, so you got to think of what are those problems and issues that keep them up at night. And so once I started accepting that as part of my journey in the forest, you know, whether I was talking to somebody in applications, let's say in formulations development or downstream bioprocessing, whatever it was, okay, what is it that keeps them up at night? Because they don't care to buy my product or not. It makes no difference to them. They just want to solve something. So once that really started hitting home, that was my journey into the forest. And what is it that's keeping them up at night? And then having them tell me, and I would actually ask them, what are the biggest things that bother you when you come in here? What is the problem you're having with formulations development? And they would say, oh, this, this, and this, and this. And I'm like, okay, that's what I got to shoot for.
Yes, this concept of really staying close to your customers is so important and so informative. And like you mentioned earlier, it's really the only way to keep your true north aligned with what your customers really need and keep them coming back and offering referrals so that you can scale the business, as you mentioned.
Yes.
I think it's a real testament to the fact that you guys were doing value add work, that you had your main growth engine coming from referrals from existing clients.
Yes.
Had the opportunity to grow your business. Tell me a little bit about what the team structure looked like and what, if any, adjustments you had to make over time to support that scale.
Sure. In terms of the team, you know, it started out with really, again, a core in sales and marketing abilities, and then the ability in terms of business operations. My partner, John Morris, is really a master at business operations, you know, from finance and team structure and what have you. So as we were looking at the CASMEX system, when we thought of growth, it was, well, okay, we can add more sales and marketing here, and we're just going to have incremental growth, but not the growth we were looking for. And so when we were looking at the bigger picture of how commercialization done, that's where we decided, you know what, we have to do the investment here and pick up those team members that are really going to add value to what our vision is. I think sometimes the old additive of dollar, you know, penny wise and dollar foolish holds true, where we want to try to spend as least money as we possible, as we can. And I'm really reverse in that I really want to invest in my team as much as I can. You know, people are very, I know this kind of sounds hokey, but people are very important. And particularly once you find those individuals that are really great at what they do and they fit within the broader shape of your company culture, I think that's key. And so once we've been able to quote unquote capture those individuals, we really like to do our best to make sure they're treated well, to make sure they're comfortable, and to make sure they feel like people. And I stress that a lot because, you know, there's an old additive, you don't want to share too much in the business community because people could use that against you. And I always hated that additive. I really did. Because we're all human and we all have instances happen in our life. That's my involvement with autism because of my own personal life history. So I wanted to make an environment where we recognize your value, but not only is your value is what you bring to the business, but your value as a person. And recognize that we all have issues and problems that come up in our lives. And as opposed to ignoring those or saying, oh, don't talk about that here because you're in danger of, you know, endangering X, Y, or Z. We don't. And I don't encourage that. And I find that companies that are moving away from that old philosophy that encourage a dialogue of support for the person in general, they're flourishing much better. As opposed to the old adage of no, don't say anything about anything personal because it'll be used against you. And my personal philosophy, if that's what a company is going to do, I don't need to be there. I don't want to be there. I want someplace where I'm looked at as the person as a whole.
What does that look like in practice?
Sure. In practice, what it is, you know, we, John and I, make a big habit of extending out and letting know the other teammates a little bit about ourselves as well. For instance, I have two autistic boys, and having autistic boys and being an executive in the life sciences industry can be quite daunting because of the personal commitment involvement you have with your career, but also with your children. And in doing that, I've quote unquote exposed that because, again, when first coming into this community, it was something that was shunned. You know, you don't want to talk about your personal life. And so I had learned that, you know, sometimes if my son was having a particular issue, if he was having a rough day, I may have to call it a little bit early. I may have to call my day a little bit early and go help out, Not that I would avoid the work, but I would basically share with my team, well, I have to step out a little early because I have to help my son. He's having an issue today. But then share that experience with them and then show them that I still could get the work done and I still want to participate, but to let them know that incidents happen to me too. And John, the same way, he's been very open as a mentor where we let our employees in a little bit, know that, no, we're just not John and Eric, the CEO and the CFO. We're people as well. And we want to share our experiences with you. So we encourage dialogue amongst the employees. We have individual sharing times where we will call somebody up and ask them, you know, how are they doing? Is, you know, we have an open door policy where if you'd like to talk with us, you're more than welcome to off record, or if you just want to talk about your day, we're okay with that. We try to put that human touch in it, that it's just not a corporate world, that we're all people. We all have issues that come up in our lives and that we're here to support that as a team.
That's really powerful. And particularly within the more entrepreneurial space where you typically hear of this concept of work-life balance not really existing or work being your entire life. But it sounds like you've been able to maintain a semblance of time for family and personal things in addition to growing a very successful business. And so what has that balance looked like, or maybe the integration of work and life together, and how have you made to keep them in check?
Sure. It's a task. I'll be honest with you. It's a learning curve and a learning task. You know, when I first started my career, I was an application scientist. And that's usually, you know, for life science companies, it's someone that has, you know, either a PhD or a master's. And it's an entry-level position into the business aspect of life sciences. It's a very travel-intense career. And so at the beginning, I was traveling tremendously. My eldest son, who's now 22, he was a little baby at the time. I did a lot of traveling and I missed, you know, quite a few of his more personal instances that you would want to be involved in, you know, the first steps, you know, you name it. This is the small stuff that happened. And, you know, when he was getting older, I was realizing, boy, I'm really missing out on a lot here and I don't want to do that. While my career is important to me and the entrepreneurial spirit is within me, I still want to be a good dad and I still want to participate in his life. So I learned that, you know, being a part of a company is great. I love it. But once I'm hitting 80 to 90% travel and I cannot participate in my own life, that's got to change. That's not healthy for anybody. It really is not. And I think for everybody, that's a personal call where you may have to understand and realize that, you know, your wife or husband or significant other at home, you know, they're being as understanding as they can, but for somebody to be gone all the time, it can be very daunting and very hard. So as part of that, you know, I cut down on my travel, but I also spent a lot of late nights where I would spend time with my family. You know, I would call it a day, let's say at 5 or 6, and spend time with my family over dinner, doing homework, checking things out with them or spending time with them. And then come 8, 9 o'clock, they'd go to sleep and I'm back at my desk at work till 2, 3 in the morning. You know, so a lot of late nights and balancing. And at first, that can be quite daunting, but I found out that that trade-off was just so much beneficial, that having that time with them and making them feel important really not only helped me personally, but also career-wise. You know, when you're having, I was always taught, and I truly believe you can't balance one part of your life. You know, if you just balance your work life and focus on your work life, one of the other portions of your life, your personal life or your physical well-being is going to be out of whack. So you got to balance all three. You can't just balance one side. And so it was important to make sure I'm spending time on all three, you know, my work life, my family life, and then my health, because one of those can't be out of balance and the other two in. It's just not going to happen. Eventually, one of them's going to give. If not, two of them are going to give. May not be now, but it'll eventually happen.
Yes.
And I'm not saying I don't struggle now. I still struggle now with it, but I always ask my family members, you know, for feedback, you know, and I ask them honestly, I'm like, look, if I'm missing something or whatever, I want you to share with me, because I want to be able to participate and I want you to feel there for me, or there for them, excuse me. You know, particularly with having special needs kids, they need to be checked on. They need to make sure they're okay. And I'm not saying people within the normal spectrum are okay with it, but it's just, you got to be a little bit more hand-holding sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's really insightful that you called out not two, but three elements, not just work-life balance, but also the health piece, your own, your family's, around you. I think that's a piece that often gets overlooked, but isn't
it? It gets ignored. You know, it does get ignored. I've seen a lot of executives over the course of my career that they're forgetting that third portion and not realizing that health not only involves your physical health, but also your mental health, because the two go hand in hand. And where if you're not, you know, if you're not focusing on both your physical and mental health, when one of them goes out of whack, the other one's eventually going to collide as well. It's just a time factor. And so taking time out for Eric, whether it be some meditation or just doing something I like, I've always liked dinosaurs. Jurassic Park was my favorite movie, or one of my favorite movies. So, you know, for me, reading and studying about dinosaurs or watching shows on dinosaurs, I find very relaxing and I enjoy it. I really have. And so I always take that little bit of time to read something dinosaur-ish or related to dinosaurs, fact or fiction. It's my personal debriefment.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love dinosaurs too. It's great.
Yeah.
With all these different things that you're balancing, you've got your personal life, work, your health. Tell me about the motivation, or what gets you up in the morning that helps you when those things feel a little bit out of whack or you have a tough day.
My motivation really is two things, really. I should say a combination. One of the motivation factors is there's a lot that needs to be done and accomplished in the life science community for a variety of different reasons and a variety of different populations, not only in the US, but abroad as well. And although I'm not directly doing research, if you will, what I do and what my team does contributes to that process. It helps companies get to the next step or to broaden out what they're doing or touch more customers. And so I've always felt that we need as a society to focus tremendously on science because it's what is going to make our lives better in a variety of different aspects, not only life sciences, but natural sciences and physical sciences as well, of course. So that's really been a motivation factor for me is that, well, maybe what I'll do will, you know, the butterfly effect will somehow, even though I'm only a consultant, maybe it will impact something that somebody else is doing and it'll have a better effect later on down the line. So I look at the more holistic picture of science. That's a big motivation factor for me. And from a personal perspective, again, having special needs kids, I try to get them involved in science and business as much as I can, because, you know, one of the things that we have to realize is society is not that, oh, well, they can't learn. It's not the case. They learn differently. They learn different than we do. And they absorb information differently. So one of the things I've noticed is by exposing them to different elements, there's different things that they pick up on and different sometimes shortcomings that I've seen they picked up on really quick. So their brain is processing information differently than mine. And so that becomes a key motivating factor as well within our community, within the CASMIC, what we call ecosystem, is that when we're thinking of what we're doing, we're trying to be an inclusive company. And really that science isn't just for those that have a high, let's say, IQ or did a straight A's throughout their career, but it's for everybody and for everybody to participate in at whatever level they can. And so we like to be inclusive in that. And that's a big motivating factor for me. How can I make this more inclusive?
That's wonderful. And I love that that's the lens through which you are approaching your team building and problem solving.
When we're working on a particular project, we invite and solicit opinions throughout our team. And because, you know, you never really know what someone else's experience has been. And it may be that, let's say you feel that they're just, you know, a lawyer looking at IP, but they've interacted with customers in a different fashion than maybe I have traditionally. And so they could really shed some unique light on a problem. Or maybe the case is that I'm too on top of it. And sometimes that happens where I'm too on top of a customer problem that I can't see the leaves or the forest beyond the trees type of thing. So that's helpful that we, within our own CASMIC ecosystem here, that we solicit opinions throughout the team, regardless of what we're working on. And I found that's been really helpful.
What does victory look like to you now? And has that evolved throughout your career?
Yes. Oh boy. For me, it's always been a moving target and it's always been something, well, I want to accomplish. And for the longest time for me, X was making my own established company and a successful company. And there's, of course, always different levels of success. Now, what I would really like to do, that's been a great journey. I want to start translating that into, I've been approached a couple times about maybe writing a book or something that combines elements of what we've done, but also within the autistic community and what that looks like. So for me, it would be contributing more so than just being a consultant. And I'm not downplaying the role of consultant, but I'd like to I hate to use the word give back because I feel it's overused, somehow contribute some of the information that I've gained over the years and share with others. Maybe it's through a podcast, maybe it's through a publication. I don't know yet, but I'd like to be able to do that. That would be a victory for me because I've wanted to contribute in that fashion throughout my career. And I just felt that I needed to go through these earlier journeys first in order to get there so that I actually at the end of the road, I'd have something to say. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know, I didn't get there. I wouldn't have anything to say at the end of the road, but that's what it was.
If you could give your younger self a piece of advice, what would you say?
Don't be afraid to fail. Number one, don't be afraid to fail. We learn so much from failure. And I know that's, again, that's something that's cliche and been so repetitious with a lot of executives out there. We learn so much from failure. And I think a lot of times we try so hard to avoid failure. And no one likes to fail. And I'm not saying fail deliberately, but it's going to happen. And don't be afraid of that and realize that failure is really the best teacher. I've actually, again, I know it sounds cliche, but I've learned way, way much more from failure than I ever had from any success I've had. And that's the truth.
One last one. When you've experienced one of those failures, even if it comes with great learnings, how do you pick yourself back up from those moments?
Sure. Early on is realizing that it's not the end of the world. Really realizing, you know, that it's not the end of the world, that the best thing to do is, you know, there's the train coming at you. Sometimes the train just got to hit you and run you over and let that process happen, as opposed to fighting it when the train's crushing you. You know, sometimes you can't fight it. You just got to let the train hit you and realize that I'm going to pick myself up after this. I'm going to get back on the horse. Don't fight it. Let that train hit you so that you can start whatever that healing process looks like to get back up on the horse and can continue to be successful. That really is letting the train hit you.
Yes. And having the perspective to know that this too shall pass, it sounds like.
Yes, exactly. Yes, very much so. This too shall pass. What's the old saying? There ain't nothing permanent but death and taxes. No, this is what my grandfather used to tell me. Nothing permanent but death and taxes. Yes.
Well, Eric, thank you so much. This has been.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Insightful conversation, and we've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. It was a pleasure.